This is the Talk of Iowa Book Club. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, The 12 Tribes of Hattie by Ayanna Mathis. The book was first published in 2012, and it tells the stories of Hattie Shepherd, her 11 children, and one of her grandchildren. The book begins with the Great Migration as Hattie's family leaves Georgia following the murder of her father. They go to Philadelphia, where life is hard, but from Hattie's perspective, far better than living under the brutality of the Jim Crow South. I'll talk with author Ayanna Mathis and some expert readers. Pull up a comfy chair. It's time for Book Club.
If you love this podcast, you should know that just like all the content produced by IPR, it's fueled by listener dollars. Hi, I'm Caitlin Harrop, and I'm a producer working on the Talk of Iowa Book Club. Part of my job is talking with the guests and experts you hear on this podcast to bring thought-provoking, informative conversations to listeners like you. And when you contribute to IPR, you make those conversations possible. Membership contributions are the single largest source of funding for IPR's budget, so every dollar counts. Do your part to support the podcasts and programs you enjoy. Go to iowapublicradio.org and tap on the red donate button. Thank you.
This is the Talk of Iowa Book Club. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, we're talking about the 12 Tribes of Hattie. And when the book came out back in 2012, I spoke with author Ayanna Mathis, and I asked her to read a section of the book.
32 hours after Hattie and her mother and sisters crept through the Georgia woods to the train station, 32 hours on hard seats in the commotion of the Negro car, Hattie was startled from a light sleep by the train conductor's bellow, "Broad Street Station, Philadelphia." Hattie clambered from the train, her skirt still hemmed with Georgia mud, the dream of Philadelphia round as a marble in her mouth, and the fear of it a needle in her chest. Hattie and Mama, Pearl and Marion, climbed the steps from the train platform up into the main hall of the station. It was dim, despite the midday sun. The domed roof arched. Pigeons cooed in the rafters. Hattie was only 15 then, slim as a finger. She stood with her mother and sisters at the crowd's edge, the four of them waiting for a break in the flow of people so that they too might move toward the double doors at the far end of the station. Hattie stepped into the multitude. Mama called, "Come back! You'll be lost in all those people. You'll be lost!" Hattie looked back in panic. She thought her mother was right behind her. The crowd was too thick for her to turn back, and she was borne along on the current of people. She gained the double doors and was pushed out onto a long sidewalk that ran the length of the station. The main thoroughfare was congested with more people than Hattie had ever seen in one place. The sun was high. Automobile exhaust hung in the air alongside the tar smell of freshly laid asphalt and the sickening odor of garbage rotting. Wheels rumbled on the paving stones, engines revved, paper boys called the headlines. Across the street, a man in dirty clothes stood on the corner, wailing a song, his hands at his sides, palms upturned. Hattie resisted the urge to cover her ears to block the rushing city sounds. She smelled the absence of trees before she saw it. Things were bigger in Philadelphia, that was true, and there was more of everything, too much of everything.
Ayanna Mathis reading from the 12 Tribes of Hattie, and our expert readers will be joining the conversation very soon. But first, we are very fortunate to have Ayanna Mathis, the author of the 12 Tribes of Hattie, with us. She is a graduate of the Iowa Writers' Workshop and also taught at the workshop in recent years. She is with us today from New York. Ayanna, thank you so much for being here.
Hello, Charity. It's very nice to be with you again.
Yes.
I know we were a few years ago around when the book came out, and I'm so excited to be here for this inaugural on-air meeting of the book club. It's fantastic.
And we are so excited to have you, too. And, you know, the fact that you wrote the book in Iowa City has something to do with why I chose this as the first selection for our book club. But also because Iowa, like so many northern states, was shaped by the Great Migration. Mm. And that's where I want to start with you. What was it about the Great Migration that really captured your imagination?
Well, you know, if I'm entirely honest, when I started writing the book, it certainly wasn't about the Great Migration, actually. I kind of backed my way into this book in an odd sort of way. I started writing short stories that kept kind of being about this the younger people in the book. So not Hattie herself, but her children. And then after a time, I figured out that they were a family. And then when I figured out that they were a family, a sort of weird story appeared that was about this, at that point, unnamed character who was an older woman then, who was taking care of a sick young child. I'll spare you all the gory details and weeping and tears and writer's frustration. But fast forward, I realized that she was the mother of these children that I had been writing about. And when I realized that, I began to have to think about who she might have been, where she would have come from, how she would have gotten to Philadelphia, given the time period. A lot of the stories I was writing were set in the 1940s at first. And I thought, well, would this woman have, was she born here or did she come from somewhere else? And at that point, I understood that she had come from somewhere else and that somewhere else was the South. And that's how I kind of got to the Great Migration. And had to sort of start really thinking about what that would have meant for Hattie, the Titer character's life, her husband August's life, and for the lives of these children that they have, who are a kind of first generation born in the North.
Well, and you're writing about an early part of the Great Migration, which really covered so many decades between 1916 and 1970. Certainly did. 6 million Black Americans moving out of the South to mostly urban areas in the North. And Hattie's on sort of the leading edge of this. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the really striking things about her family's move, of course, it was in response to the murder of her father, mm-hmm. but also you see how they really become refugees within their own country because they lose everything mm-hmm. through the move.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think that's one of the really important things about the Great Migration. And I should mention here, probably a lot of your listeners have encountered this book already, but in case they haven't, there's a tremendous book about the Great Migration, kind of the seminal text. That's called The Warmth of Other Suns by a writer named Isabel Wilkerson, who did just exhaustive research about it. And that book was incredibly helpful to me. It's a nonfiction book in just sort of understanding the scope and magnitude of the migration. And I think one of the things that I discovered as I thought about it and as I read more about it was that it follows many of the patterns of any kind of migration. And very often we haven't thought of it in a migratory kind of way because we often think of that as sort of something that's kind of coming from outside of the nation into a new nation, when in reality, this is absolutely a migratory movement. It's only that it happens inside the borders. But the same sorts of patterns, people seeking a better life, people fleeing racial terrorism in this case, people fearing for their lives, for their welfare, for their children's lives and welfare. And then moving north into a place that wasn't necessarily entirely prepared for their arrival, wasn't necessarily entirely welcoming to them, to put it euphemistically. So they kind of go from this situation of great danger and peril to a place where things are better to some extent than they were in the South that they left, but where there was a really long road to go. I mean, obviously, they faced enormous racial injustice, issues around poverty and all of these kinds of things when they got to the North. So it's not an easy journey, but nonetheless, it does kind of really follow how we understand migration in the more conventional sense.
The novel is written through a series of vignettes, and listening to you talk about those short stories that you started with, that helps me understand how it came to be. But it's not a long narrative novel. No. We jump in and out of Hattie's life, and we see her through these vignettes that tell us about the lives of her children, some of them when they're very small, some of them much later in life. Why did you decide you wanted to write the novel this way?
Well, in part, you know, it was cheating. as I said, I thought I was working on some short stories. But as it turns out, I'm not a short story writer. I really am a novelist. I just tend to do these things perhaps in this novel in a slightly unconventional way. As I wrote through, this woman kept appearing. And what I realized was that she was the novel's life's blood, so to speak. She was absolutely the through line. She's difficult. She's gone through a lot of difficulties in her life, particularly in her very early life as a very, very young woman. When we meet her, she is only 17 years old, and something very difficult happens to her at that point. And she essentially spends the rest of her life recovering from it. In addition to that, she's just a complicated figure. And one of the things that I began to understand as I tried to write about her was that I didn't understand her. I couldn't figure out how to sort of take her head on and explain her in any sort of fullness. What I realized was important to the novel and important to me as a writer was that we understand her entirely through the lens of her children. And so that's how this kind of structure came to be.
You said this was a way of cheating, but I imagine that when you had to connect all of the dots and make sure that all those dots lined up, that it was an incredible undertaking because you do. It spans from, 1923 was the first introduction, and then through the 1980s. So you're crossing generations and decades and all of these people interacting in their memories, et cetera. Yeah. So lining all of those pieces up must have been an extraordinary task.
It was. It's a friend of mine calls it novel math. As you mentioned, the novel spans about 60 years. One of the things that had to happen was that I had to make sure that I was dealing appropriately with the way her children would understand her as they got further away from their childhoods. There's sort of delicate calibrations that were absolutely necessary. I think without them, the novel would be a failure because it wouldn't read as believable or true, and we wouldn't have a sense of the truth of these characters' experience of their lives and of their mother, but we also wouldn't really get a sense of the arc of Hattie's life. She wouldn't feel to us like a character who was changing through the arc of her life if I didn't have to be so attentive to the way that her children perceive her based on how old they are and how far they are away from their childhoods.
Back when we first spoke in 2012, you had really just received news that Oprah had picked the book for her book club 2.0. And of course, since then, this book has become an international bestseller, translated into languages, read all over the world. And it's such an American story. Mm-hmm. What do you think readers around the world take away from delving into the lives of these characters?
On a really broad level, I think that there's a great deal of interest in African-Americanness, for lack of a better term. I could say something like the Black experience, but I actually don't believe that that's a thing. But I do think that there's a great deal of interest in sort of the history of Black Americans in this country. And I think that there's also a kind of paucity of knowledge in a certain sense. So people outside of the United States have a certain set of markers. You know, well, there was slavery and there was Martin Luther King and then there was, you know, hip hop or whatever it is. But there's not a lot of sort of connective tissue, also because so many African-American cultural products have been exported, hip-hop, jazz, the blues, et cetera, et cetera. And then I think on a more sort of personal reader kind of level, I can say even from just going on book tour, which I did here in the U.S. and abroad, people would approach a lot and talk about their relationships with their mothers or other family members that were really fraught. I think that many, many people can relate to this notion of someone that loves you and that you love and with whom you feel a certain kind of barrier or an obstacle to receiving that love or understanding that love or feeling that love. And in many ways, this is a book about familial love that is that comes from their mother in a way that the children don't quite understand or recognize as love exactly. And I think that that's a pretty universal story. And I think that that's one of the reasons it's resonated with people so much.
Ayanna Mathis, we are going to take a short break. We're talking about the 12 Tribes of Hattie. This is the Talk of Iowa Book Club.
If you love books and this podcast, join IPR's Talk of Iowa Book Club Facebook group. You can ask Charity what she's reading for work or for fun. Get inside information about upcoming book club episodes, answer questions to shape our book discussions, and find other like-minded readers to share observations and recommendations. Join our community of readers in IPR's Talk of Iowa Book Club Facebook group.
It's the Talk of Iowa Book Club. I'm Charity Nebbe. We are talking about The 12 Tribes of Hattie by Ayanna Mathis, and we are very fortunate to have Ayanna Mathis with us today. I also want to bring our expert readers into the conversation. Rochelle Chase is here. She is author of Lost Buxton and Creating the Black Utopia of Buxton, Iowa. Hello, Rochelle.
Well, hello, Charity, and hello, Ayanna. It's so nice to be here.
Maeve Clark is also here, a recently retired librarian from the Iowa City Public Library. She lives in Iowa City. Hello, Maeve.
Good morning. Nice to see you.
I want to start off by talking just a little bit more about the Great Migration. And Ayanna and I were talking about how this period inspired her, or she found that she needed to place her characters in part of this movement. And Rochelle, I'd love to hear your thoughts. You've written so much about Buxton, Iowa, which predated the Great Migration, but many African Americans moving north for opportunity in Buxton, Iowa with the coal mine. There, in plunging into these stories about this family that moved north, what were your thoughts?
Well, it was interesting in that, you know, when I think about the Buxton experience and the African Americans coming from the South, mainly Virginia, and when they got here, it was so different, and to be treated equal and to be able to be whatever you wanted to be without restriction was so new. So I didn't really hear a lot of African Americans talk about the South with a sense of nostalgia. And so I wanted to ask you, Ayanna, in the 12 Tribes of Hattie, August especially seems to have a little bit of a nostalgia. And I'm wondering if that's because, you know, they came from the South to a place that was better than what they had been, but it wasn't like the Buxton experience where you came and it really was totally different from being in the South. So I guess my question is, do you feel like maybe that can contribute to their kind of little bit of nostalgia about the South because it wasn't so different? Whereas had they come to some place like a Buxton where they're really, it was so, you know, at equal that they would have felt differently.
Mm. It's a great question. I think that Buxton is fairly unique. I think that more often than not, people were coming into situations in all the sort of streams of the migration. So the kind of Northeast,
exactly.
You know, Philadelphia, New York, Boston,
yep.
Et cetera. Chicago, of course, a big place that people went. And then these kind of Western streams. You know, there's a long history of things like housing discrimination. We know about things like redlining. The experience that my folks have in this book, I think, is not necessarily out of keeping with a lot of experiences in the Great Migration. And so certainly I do think that would contribute to a sense of nostalgia. I also think that it's important to keep in mind, too, that people would have been having, this is a lot of people, right? Like it's 6 million
mm-hmm.
people. So people mm-hmm. are having all kinds of varied experiences. And I think mm-hmm. just like in any sort of, you know, so some people are having experiences that feel mostly positive to them, some people mostly negative, most people, I suspect,
right.
somewhere in between. People's understanding of their experience is not monolithic. So I think...
Mm-hmm.
And it's also the case that people, you know, it was home. It's
right.
That's the thing that I think is so nuanced about it, you know, because
right.
it was difficult in wherever people were coming from doesn't mean that it wasn't home.
In the chapter that takes place in 1954, the chapter is called Ella because that's the child that we're focusing on. But
mm-hmm.
that chapter also gives us a glimpse into the life of Pearl, who is Hattie's sister, mm-hmm. who went north with the family but then chose to return to the South. Ayanna, that chapter really gives us a sense of the compromises that she had to make to live the life that she wanted to live
mm-hmm.
by moving south. We see how limited she is in the South, but we also see that her life is more comfortable
mm-hmm.
than Hattie's life in the North.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That chapter was really important to me because I didn't want to I didn't want to present something that made it seem as though it was categorically better to go north and that people had sort of one right. kind of relationship to it. I think that that's very important. And I think certainly if so many people hadn't remained in the South, we wouldn't have been able to have a civil rights movement, you know. So I wanted I wanted to make sure that homage was paid in some kind of way to people who either, you know, decided not to migrate or people who did migrate and found the whole thing just sort of not at all to their liking or not worth it or, you know, whatever their relationship might have been and returned south, which is also a thing that happened.
Mm-hmm. Maeve, did you want to bring up anything you thought about with exploring the Great Migration?
Well, one of the things I thought was particularly moving in that chapter that you just spoke about, Charity, was when they stopped to have a picnic on their way mm-hmm. north and how these were very successful people. He ran a funeral home, is that right?
That's right, yeah.
And they had a car. They had done very, very well for themselves, but they were still in the South, and white people felt free to do whatever they wanted to them. And it was a terrifying part of that chapter because you didn't really know what was going to happen. And I think that throughout the book, there is so much complexity to each of your characters, and particularly Hattie. I mean, she starts out with this feeling of wonder when she gets to Philadelphia and she doesn't have to walk in the gutter anymore and that things are so different. And then she has those two children and they die. Mm-hmm. And they die a horrible death. And she's an incredibly strong character, but she's not particularly a loving character. And that goes through all the way through the book with her relationship with her children, her husband, only her lover, perhaps, and then finally at the end of the book. So thank you for writing this. It was a wonderful read.
That makes me want to bring up another topic that I really want to explore, and that is this social isolation. Mm-hmm. And Hattie feels so alone. And, you know, I think part of that is moving from Georgia to Philadelphia, leaving the kin that would have naturally surrounded her. And she lost her mother shortly after moving to Philadelphia. But she is also a woman who does not ask for help, who does not try to create community. And her circumstances are so hard, I can't really fault her for that. But I wanted her to ask for help.
Yeah. Ayanna. Yeah, yeah. She, I think she's sort of, I was really interested in, part of what I was interested in writing the book is, you know, there's all these siblings, of course, but they don't rely on one another. You know, we meet each of them, generally speaking, in some pretty tough moment or pivotal moment in their lives, but they don't turn to anyone very often for help. And I was interested in what that dynamic would look like in a family, particularly in such a large family, and what I realized was that they were kind of that was coming from their mother, you know, that they had sort of received this legacy of isolation from their mother, who was so stoic and so tough and so private. That is both a result, as you said, Charity, of the fact that she has been sort of ripped away from the kind of social fabric that would have been, you know, kind of part of her life. And I think it's also a fact of her southernness. You know, there's a sort of fierce privacy there that I think is a very southern quality. It's not one that we often think of as southernness, you know, because we think of southern people as being really gregarious and talking and et cetera, et cetera. But I've found very often that gregariousness is sort of a layer over a very core privacy that is particularly true of Black people and in the South that I think probably arises out of the racial circumstance that existed there for so long. But in any case, so she's got this kind of privacy and also a pride and a fierceness about her that makes her think that she should and can go it alone. And I think she also has a certain I don't think that she expects anyone to be able to help her meaningfully. And then, of course, without meaning to do that, she transmits that legacy of isolation to her children.
Well, and it's also when she goes through that really traumatic event at the beginning, one of the traumatic events, obviously the murder of her father was an incredibly traumatic event, and then moving, but then losing two children to pneumonia is mm-hmm. so traumatic. And I can look at that through a modern lens and think about the kind of depression and PTSD that would result from that kind of experience and how paralyzed she is by that. And it just, it's heartbreaking to think that she had no recourse. Those weren't words that people had. That wasn't an experience that you would ask for help with. Rochelle, did you want to add anything about this sort of sense of social isolation?
Yeah, that was something that struck me, was that isolation that all of them, and I'm glad that you pointed out that it was, you know, that Hattie inadvertently taught them that. Because it seems like it is something that they struggled with, you know, throughout the book, you know, how to connect, you know, in a healthy way with people. And so I guess my point is, when you were writing that, was that something that you intentionally wanted to convey, you know, in the book?
In a certain sense, yes. Once I realized that I was sort of writing a novel about quite a large family, I realized that one of the things I was interested in was writing a narrative in which there wouldn't be a whole lot of scenes of all the family together and that kind of thing. And so as I went on, I began to realize that I did kind of want to explore them in their isolation, that I wanted to kind of put them in these very critical moments in their lives. Sometimes the moments are very difficult or dark or bleak. Sometimes they're just moments of extraordinary change. And that I wanted to sort of see how they would be in those moments without having recourse in a direct way to their siblings or to their mother. That one of the things that would come to their aid, or that would be difficult for them in these crucial moments in their lives, would be their kinds of memories and their past and whatever it is that their upbringing had taught them.
I'm going to interrupt right there. Let's pick up with this when we come back in just a moment. We are talking about the novel, The 12 Tribes of Hattie. With me, author Ayanna Mathis. Also, our expert readers are here today. Maeve Clark, recently retired librarian from the Iowa City Public Library, and Rochelle Chase, author of Lost Buxton and Creating the Black Utopia of Buxton, Iowa. She lives in Ottumwa. This is the Talk of Iowa Book Club.
If you love the Talk of Iowa Book Club podcast, check out another great podcast from Iowa Public Radio, Under the Golden Dome. Host John Pemble takes you inside the Iowa State House to hear decisions being made in committee rooms or on the floor of the House and Senate. Not only do you hear from the lawmakers crafting legislation each week, but also the Iowans who will be impacted by the policies being debated. A new season of Under the Golden Dome begins each January with the Iowa legislative session. Check it out wherever you get your podcasts.
This is the Talk of Iowa Book Club. We are talking about The 12 Tribes of Hattie by Ayanna Mathis. It's a book that spans many decades, from the Great Migration through about 1980. Ayanna Mathis is with us today. Also, our expert readers, Rochelle Chase, author of Lost Buxton and Creating the Black Utopia of Buxton, Iowa, and Maeve Clark, a recently retired librarian in Iowa City. And I want to explore the idea of home. When I was reading about Hattie and August buying a home, I found myself thinking about how in recent years we've heard a lot fewer people are able to buy their homes or are buying their homes, but also how the policies that robbed so many Black families of opportunities to be homeowners affect that family and so many families for generations. I've been thinking about that home in Georgia that Hattie's family left, and they weren't able to pass that on to their family. And we have generations in the United States stuck in poverty because there's just nothing to pass on. Home ownership, that was such a big moment for Hattie and August to get that house after 50 years. And that house symbolized more than just a house. Ayanna, what did it mean to you to have that moment with Hattie?
I think a couple of things. On the sort of, I guess, more micro character level, it was a kind of a lifelong realization, and it was something that made her feel sort of legitimized. And I think something that made her feel not that all of those years of struggle were worth it, but that in any case, something had changed. There had been a betterment. And then on a larger level, the notion of home ownership, it was something that's really that I think about a lot. And the notion of Black property ownership is something that I think about a lot. And you're very right to kind of point to the fact that when they left Georgia, that whatever land they owned a house. There was some land around it. Her father was a blacksmith. He owned that shop and that land, too. All of that was lost to them, or stolen from them, actually. So that kind of legacy of kind of property theft and loss is enormous. I mean, many, many millions and millions of millions of dollars, millions and millions of dollars of potential Black wealth and stability that either were stolen or robbed or left sitting there because of circumstances. And then you kind of combine that with the sorts of things that happened in the North, like redlining practices by which banks literally would draw red lines on maps that would prevent potential Black homeowners from being able to get mortgages and things like that. So when you think about that kind of stuff, the financial toll is astronomical. And that, so that was something that I was kind of gesturing toward in a narrative way.
I want to talk about motherhood, because obviously this is a theme that comes around and around again. And Hattie is the mother of these 11 children and maybe doesn't meet our modern standards of a good mother. But there it's a very complicated thing. And Maeve, why don't I let you kick it off? What strikes you about Hattie as a mother that you want to explore?
There's so much about her as a mother that's kind of an anti-mother. That for one thing, having that many children, so the first two die, but she has 9 children in that very small apartment, and they spread themselves out, but she seems to always know where they are. And the lack of warmth with her relationships with her children. I mean, she's doing the best she can with them. Her husband gambles away all of the money and has women on the side. And so she always has food for them. They're always clean. They're always well taken care of. But you don't see a joyous feeling coming out of that. And so each chapter tells you another part of what happened to each of those children because of that. I mean, Charity and I were just talking about Alice and how she has this wonderful house and a husband who's very successful, but she's drugged most of the time. And then her maid, she has a maid, has a relationship with her brother, and she's hateful and hurtful to them. So there's so many complexities and so many layers to these relationships. I can't imagine 9 children not having any money in a tiny apartment in a big city. So she's really a remarkable woman in many ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And Ayanna, I mean, I think last time we spoke, you talked about having a hard time finding sympathy for Alice. She was, I believe, maybe your least favorite character.
She is, yeah.
Yeah. Poor Alice. Poor Alice. But it is so interesting to see Hattie, because she keeps these children alive. Without her, and we do see this very clearly, without her, God knows what would have happened mm-hmm. to these children. There's a 24-hour period where she's missing and things fall apart.
It's a mess.
Right.
Right.
Exactly. So she's doing a remarkable thing given all of her personal challenges, and yet the affection isn't there. And so for so many eyes, she would be failed as a mm-hmm. mother. What's your feeling about Hattie as a mother?
I think she's complicated. If you're a person whose children have died, that's not an abstraction anymore. It is a very real possibility, if not, I think, almost in Hattie's head, not quite a probability, but it's something that's very present for her. So some of the ways in which she shows these children love is by keeping them alive. You mm-hmm. know, they're fed, they're clothed, they're safe for the most part. And so I think that that's very important. And I think that she also, in a certain way, is trying to kind of toughen them up, you know, because I don't think that she expects the world to deal kindly with them. And so she sort of wants to send them out into the world prepared for that eventuality. And I think also she's gone through so much, like just this kind of catastrophic series of losses before she's even 20 years old. I think that makes it really difficult for her to be a kind of huggy, kissy, milk and cookies kind of mom.
Well, and there is this moment in Belle's chapter where Belle gets a glimpse of the mother, the woman that Hattie could have been if life had not been so cruel, because she sees Hattie actually laughing and enjoying herself with someone who's not in the family.
But that turns out so poorly.
It does not go well.
Oh, my gosh. I was not prepared for that. Wanamakers. Oh, my goodness.
But that does... That was so heartbreaking, Ayanna, because then I thought, you know, she was only 17 years old when she lost those babies. And we get this glimpse of the joyful, loving woman she could have been if life had not tried to crush her so hard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I really wanted that. That was really important to me, that we see sort of in the beginning that when she arrives in Philadelphia in 1925, you know, she's so young and she's full. I mean, she even gives her children these names, Philadelphia Jubilee. And so it was important to me that the reader see her like that. And it was important for me as the writer to see her like that, and then to sort of see again a kind of potential, as you guys put it, what the happiness she could have had, and the happiness that she was still capable of feeling or accessing, albeit in a very limited kind of way. And I wanted to mention before, which I think is really important, I was very interested in making sure that she was a rounded, full character. I didn't want to play into stereotypes or tropes around Black women and resilience and strength, which I think are dehumanizing. You know, this notion that a person just could march through life with all of these horrible things happening to them and not be affected. Hattie is very flawed. Part of one of the things that's difficult about her as a mother is that she's filled with rage. She's very angry. And I didn't want to obscure that. I wanted to make sure that she was experienced by the reader and by me as fully human, but certainly not a saint.
Yeah. Rochelle, anything you want to bring up about Hattie as a mother?
Well, I was going to say, it's interesting, Charity, you had asked, you know, who the favorite character was, you know, online, and I didn't have an answer then because I was still, you know, reading. But I really feel like it was Hattie for the various reasons that you said, the complexity of her character, the fact that she was flawed. I mean, even when we see her, you know, leaving, you know, she's, you know, taking, you know, Ruthie, and she's going to leave for a bit. It's like, wow, I wasn't expecting that, you know, nor I didn't know where it was going to go. Is she going to come back? Is she going to, you know, is she going to go? But this aspect of her and what we perceive as being a good mother, you know, I think you said it in Alice's chapter, I think, where she is thinking and she's talking about, you know, if she had been this huggy and kissy kind of mom, you know, what would that have done for her kids? There's this idea that if I can provide you and face you for a world, make you prepared for a world that is not going to want you, that is more important to me than the huggy kisses. And to me, I have known, you know, older African Americans, that is the outlook on life. It's like, I need to prepare you for a world that's not going to want you. I'm not really concerned about hugs and kisses. So that was really, really powerful for me. That really resonated a lot, Hattie's character.
Thank you.
We only have a few minutes left. And one of the things that I really love about this book, Ayanna, is how deeply I experience the lives of all of these characters whose life experiences are so very different from my own. Personally, I have made an effort to diversify my reading and make sure that I'm reading books by authors of different backgrounds, of different experiences than my own, which has been really powerful and enriching for me. And I can imagine that for a lot of your readers, I mean, this book has reached so many people who probably wouldn't have walked into a bookstore saying, you know, I'm looking for a book written by a person of color. How do you think about that and the kind of empathy that we experience when we read a book like this?
I think it's incredibly important. I mean, and I guess one of the things that I think is that in a certain way, a book like mine, or for some reason as you were talking, the book Pachinko came to mind, which is just a tremendous book. And I thought about the ways in which literature not only creates things like empathy, but also just provides us with a certain kind of education about experiences that are different from ours, you know, time periods, you know, all of these kinds of things, histories, all of that sort of stuff. And at the same time, one of the things that I think, what I hope always is that I think because we live in such a racially divided country, we tend to keep always having to put adjectives on all of our cultural products, right? It's an African-American novel. It's a Korean-American novel. It's a, you know, blah, 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 on and on and on. When in reality, the kind of purpose of art is to arrive at a good and edifying description of some iteration of what it means to be a human being. And so it is always my hope that when people read a book like mine or by any person of color, that they're not sort of walking away with it just going, oh, I learned something about African Americans. What I'm hoping, which they may well, and that's great. And I hope that that is also the case. But I hope that that's not the sole thing that they walk away with. What I hope that they walk away with is, I've read a book about some human beings, and because I am a human being, I can understand various aspects of that experience. That is not to negate the fact of the blackness of these characters, but only to say that one of the great projects I think that we need to engage in as a country, as a whole, is to expand our understanding of what a human being is. And the ways in which different kinds of human beings' experiences are no less human, even if they're different from ours.
Well, Ayanna Mathis, thank you so much for sharing this really remarkable book with us and for your generosity with your time, for being part of this conversation. That's really been wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a great hour.
We have been talking about The 12 Tribes of Hattie by Ayanna Mathis, and also big thanks to our expert readers, Maeve Clark and Rochelle Chase. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is the Talk of Iowa Book Club. See you next time. The Talk of Iowa Book Club podcast is produced by Caitlin Harrop and edited by Monica Starr. We get technical support from Dennis Reese, and our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. This podcast is a production of Iowa Public Radio.
The way Iowans consume news has changed a lot since the coronavirus pandemic hit in 2020. But people here still need to know what's going on in the state every day. What are leaders saying?
The virus isn't going away until we have a vaccine.
How are medical professionals reacting, and how is it affecting hospital staff and schools?
Those weekends where you are on the phone and sending emails and, you know, dealing with people with a very emotional issue has been really hard.
I'm Clay Masters. In 2021, Iowa Public Radio is starting a podcast called Here First. It's a quick daily show for your work week that catches you up on state news as you begin your day. Get analysis from IPR's team of reporters.
Most of the improvement in the unemployment picture comes from more than 90,000 Iowans no longer looking for work.
Find out when high-profile politicians are in the state.
Back at the state fair!
Learn about what's going on in state government and discover Iowans you might not hear about otherwise.
This is the first time I've spoken with a woman without documents who's also unafraid of sharing her story on the radio.
Subscribe to Iowa Public Radio's Here First wherever you get your podcasts.